This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector. Investigative conversations about issues that impact our lives. Be curious. Friday mornings at 9 a.m. only on 101.9 High FM.
This is The Deep Dive. Of course it is, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector. And this is on High FM, of course. Today's guest, sometimes we do things that are, you know, massive geopolitical issues or economics or even nuclear physics, which we've done a couple times, or more down-to-earth topics. And sometimes we do the arts. And today we're going to reach way back in history, back before they were calendars and clocks and anything else. And we're going to talk about the Origin Center. And we're going to talk in particular to the newly designated, newly appointed head of the Origin Center on the campus of the University of the Witwatersrand. And her name is Dr. Tammy Hotchkiss-Reynard, who is otherwise known as the Ochre Lady. Ochre, and I'll let her explain what ochre is and why. But first, congratulations on becoming the head of what should be one of the more important institutions in education, spoken broadly, the campus of the university, or really across the country and perhaps even globally. And welcome to our program. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
I have to get this question figured out. You're called the, you've gained a moniker, the Ochre Lady. What is ochre and why is it even important? Why should we bother to consider it? It's sort of like ground up rock. What's the point of ochre?
Yeah, so ochre is, it's an iron-rich rock or even an iron-rich soil. So usually reds and yellows and oranges. That we know more recently it's still used around the world for many different, you know, rituals and medicinal things. But going a little bit further back, it's used for all the rock art pigments, or most of the rock art pigments, as the main ingredient that gives the color. And then going even further back, which is where I looked, where a lot of my research is based, in the Middle Stone Age in South Africa, at the time when humans are becoming human. And it's all those questions of when did we start being these beings that practiced ritual and symbolism. And so that's ochre, especially red ochres, are found at the same time, that they were ground up into pigments. No rock art yet. We don't know what they were used for. And so my research has been looking at different sites around South Africa to see, to look more into that and try figure that out. It's just become my love, and it's something that I've brought into Origin Center as well, that people get the chance to make their own pigments, or sometimes walk around campus and collect shales and things and bash them up and make pigments and make their own paint.
Well, two questions sort of naturally arise out of that. I mean, ground up rock isn't a really stable thing to put on a cave wall or something. I mean, it flakes off mm-hmm. and lands on the ground. So presumably it's mixed with something, some sort of emulsifying agent that would help it stick. And I'm guessing this is animal fat or some other derivative of an animal, what used to be an animal, or maybe blood even. I guess that's possible too. Somewhere I have read that this question of using materials like ochre represent, and you sort of foreshadowed that by talking about ritual, that this represents the earliest versions of what we think of as human consciousness, thinking about symbols and symbology and the future or the past or the hereafter. As a result, then, ochre becomes the window through which we begin to figure out what's human behavior and what's not. Am I summarizing your entire body of research in a minute?
That basically is it. It comes at this time where we are questioning that. And there's other evidence as well, you know, so really innovative stone tool behaviors that tell us something about how brains were working. But we're seeing this social network, especially, so say from 160,000 years ago. So we know we're anatomically modern humans, but what were we actually capable of? And so ochre is one of those things that comes with that toolkit. So this much better understanding of the environment and how to manipulate raw materials to change them into something else. So, and ochre was one of those, and predominantly red ochre. So that's why a lot of the thinking was that it was used more for ritual and symbolic activities. But yeah, but it might have been used for, I mean, I suppose painting and a lot of the rock art paint is very spiritual and very ritually associated as well. But yeah, so the use, the earliest use of ochre is exactly what you said, that looking at when did we become the beings that we are today.
This is radio, of course, but I'm looking at Tammy through the miracle of online video conferencing. Mm-hmm. And just for a second, she held up her hand in front of her face with all of her fingers extended. And I had this moment, this flashing moment in my mind of one of the earliest cave paintings somewhere, I can't remember where, which was the profile of a human hand against the wall, and presumably the coloring was blown onto it, either from the mouth or a tube or some way of thing. And the end result is a human hand against a series of other illustrations or images, almost as if to say, I did this. This is me. I'm John. I'm Mr. John Neanderthal, and I did this. Am I reading too much into that?
Well, I often wonder about handprints, because you do find them around the world and you think, yeah, was it, or even fingerprints, you know, was it someone putting themselves in it and this is me? Or yeah, adding to some ritual artwork where everyone together was either putting their hands, you know, putting it on a surface where there's a lot of paint and then putting the hand on the surface, or like you said, blowing paint around it. But we don't know for sure. There's been some research into left and right-handedness, you know, as well. Like, which hand would you use? Or some with missing fingers. So that's also quite interesting. So you do see a lot more. Yeah, you actually see the person that put it in, because it is their handprint or the silhouette of their hand. So, and you find that around the world.
I remember it being, as a child, using finger paints. We didn't have ground up rock and we didn't put them in our mouths. You did the other version of this, which was to dip your hand in some sort of coloring agent and putting it on a canvas or a wall or a piece of paper or whatever it is. It's sort of like the positive version of the negative that we were just talking about. Yeah. But that seems to be a really deep-seated thing that, you know, those of us who claim to be humans want to do.
So covering ourselves with ochre as well, you know, having this, whether it's, because ochre is also antibacterial and antifungal, so it could have this practical purpose of covering yourself with ochre, but it's also this beautiful, like the Himba in Namibia, who now cover themselves in this beautiful red ochre paste. And, you know, it has this amazing visual quality, but also is really good for your skin. And maybe perhaps that connection with the earth, you know, where the ochre was collected from. So there's a lot we don't necessarily know why people did the things that they did in the past or now.
Yeah, so here we are. This is the metaphysics of ground up hydrated ferrous oxide, to give it its chemical name, I guess, and how it goes back 130, 40, 50,000 years into the future, as people around the world still use face painting, body painting in ritual and symbolic circumstances. Let me switch topics just a little bit. Away from your own personal research, tell us a little bit about the Origin Center. I mean, its name is very emblematic, but what exactly is it and what does it do and what should people expect when they get there?
Firstly, it's an amazing museum that I think is very underrated. It's a really beautiful space and a kind of little hideaway in the busyness of Joburg right by the highway. But the name is actually quite misleading. A lot of people think it's the Origin Center, it's looking at the origins of humans, but it's actually looking more at the origins of art and of humanity and humanity's ability to be creative and innovative. So the museum, which is based at Wits University, we're within the science faculty, it starts with kind of looking at the, you know, the earliest technologies and us becoming human, but then the rest of the museum is actually focusing on, you know, the earliest art that we find, and then the diversity of art forms, especially with the San and the Khoi, so hunter-gatherers and the first herders in Southern Africa. So a lot of beautiful rock art. Then the museum has a mix of original pieces of, you know, artifacts and rock art, but also has really awesome contemporary art visualizations of that. So it's a bit of a mix of an art gallery and a museum. Yeah, and it's quite a big space. It's a beautiful space to come and explore. It's a bit of an adventure. It's quite dark and a bit of like a maze. And we also have this really nice connection to the academics. So it's kind of a way of bringing a lot of the research that's done in academia and specifically at FITS and bringing that to the public in a really nice, accessible way.
We're going to take a quick ad break. This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest today, Dr. Tammy Hotchkiss-Reynard, of the newly appointed director of the Origin Center on the campus of the University of the Witwatersrand. And we'll be back in just a minute. As we used to say in the 20th century, don't touch that dial.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and my guest today, Dr. Tammy Hotchkiss-Reynard, otherwise known as the Ochre Lady. And I just love that because this is a wonderful field of research and endeavor that combines archaeology, paleoarchaeology, contemporary anthropology, and art all at the same time. It's an amazing combination of things. And she is now the head of, shortly ago, she's now the head of the Origin Center on the campus at FITS. The Origin Center is tucked away a bit. It's the casual bystander or passerby might have a little trouble figuring out where it is, even though it sits pretty much on the top of the hill that the university is on. How do we get there and how do we get in?
That is a tricky thing. And I think from the outside, even if you're on campus, I think a lot of students don't realize what's inside and that it's a public space. And so it's something that I definitely want to work on is how do we bring people in and how do we make it more accessible? So you can get onto campus. There's parking right at Origins. You just do need to show your ID, whether you're coming by foot or by car. And there is parking right at Origins Center. And the museum is open Mondays to Saturdays. We often have events in the evenings. If we have exhibition openings, we have lots of temporary exhibitions and things. So sometimes in the evening we open as well, or we have kids' activity days and different things. You do pay to go come into the museum, but there's also free events as well. So we try to make it accessible to everybody, but it's definitely worth the money that you pay. We try to keep the costs as low as possible just to cover our own costs. But it's a beautiful space and worth a little bit of a mission to get onto FITS campus to to come and see.
I'm waiting for the day when you invite me to an event and it's paint yourself with ochre day and have every kid lined up with a bunch of red and yellow and orange paints and they get to paint each other or themselves and then scare the life out of their parents when they get home. That will be
Yeah, and we do have fun ochre workshops, and we have a lot of school kids coming through, and we do the ochre workshops very often with the school kids, and I love the transition. Some of them don't want to get their hands dirty at first, and with ochre, it just gets everywhere, and sometimes then they'll start painting their skin and their faces and things, and I do worry what their parents think when they come home, but luckily it washes off. And I do think as adults, we need to have fun more and paint more as well. So maybe a full one where we actually do, let's paint our bodies, wear clothes you don't mind getting dirty yet would be a fun one.
Do it on the 30th of October, just before Halloween.
Ah, yeah, that's a good idea. Go for the blood red ochre. Then. Yeah, it's a good idea.
Question that's it doesn't trouble me, but it intrigues me, really. This country, especially, as I have read it, something like 40% of all the early hominin remains and artifacts even have been found within the confines of South Africa. And many of those items are in the vaults in the university in various parts of the departments at the university. How do you work so that that material, which is quite clearly irreplaceable and therefore invaluable and almost uninsurable, how do you coordinate or bring that material and information and the texture of these things into what you're going to be doing at the Origin Center?
Yeah, so we work quite a lot with the Evolutionary Studies Institute, where the most of the fossils are. The Karoo fossils, so looking at, pre-mammal reptiles and dinosaurs and fossil plants as well, all the way up to the hominin fossils. And they're literally just across the road from us at WITS. And so we do work with them a lot, especially Prof. Bernard Zipfel, who's the curator there, and Sifilani Jira. We work with them a lot to actually try have the objects on display here when we can. So we've had the Taung child and Littlefoot here with whole heap of security as well, and make sure very secure cabinets. But it is something that, these collections WITS is curating and conserving. It's not, they don't own them. They are just making sure they're safe, and they should be viewed by the public. So we do work with them a lot to try and have them on display here when, as often as possible.
Yeah, because I confess I'm fascinated by this stuff. One of the earliest books I ever read was, that's a little bit far afield from human remains, obviously, was a book by Roy Chapman Andrews, one of the early paleontologists in the U.S., all about dinosaurs. And it was at one point one of my life dreams to go to the Gobi Desert, to the Flaming Cliffs, and find myself a piece of dinosaur fossil.
Yeah.
And when I lived in Indonesia, to my everlasting regret, I did not go to the site where Solo Man had been discovered in the late 1800s. Mm. I kept putting it off, and then we were transferred away, and so I never got to go there. But I have done multiple trips to the various sites at the cradle of humankind under the guidance of various of the researchers, which was more than just a treat. It was like it was a life experience for me. So the same question applies, not just lections on the WITS campus, but facilities that you have under your purview now, and all of the items and displays and working research areas at the cradle of humankind. How do you integrate this rich, I'm not sure how to describe it, this rich amount of real material that opens doors and windows into a very distant past?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's the Stack Vincent Caves, obviously, in Maripeng, who we in regular contact with to look at ways that, that the science isn't completely removed from the public. And I think it's important, and Lee Berger has been amazing with that, with allowing people to view the excavations and making it, all the discoveries and the whole process of doing the science and the research more accessible. And there's really exciting finds all the time. And so I think it's important for museums to kind of bridge that divide between the research papers that come out that most people won't read or don't understand because it's in, scientific jargon, and finding ways to, okay, well, let's put this on display, or let's make exhibitions or educational material for school kids that they actually know what's found right here on the doorstep. You can go down into Stack Vincent Caves and actually see where these specimens were discovered and kind of imagine what it was like 2-3 million years ago. Those time frames are just like so hard to comprehend for most of us, and let alone for kids. So I think it's our responsibility as museums to see how we can bridge that divide. And we definitely work a lot. Now Stack Vincent is fully under WITS and the running of Stack Vincent as well. And so as the science enterprise at WITS. And so I'm looking forward to a little bit, a lot more conversation, seeing how we can have researchers that are working at these sites come to Origin Center and give a public lecture, so the public can actually meet the researcher and ask the questions that they have about dating or what it was like to go in the cave or those kind of things. Yeah, I think my job and what I love about it is that it's at this bridge of the academic and the public, and it offers a lot of opportunities.
Your comments bring to mind the question that the sort of the anti-science approach that too many people, in my mind at least, are taking maybe in this country, but certainly in the United States as well these days, that none of this stuff, that this is all contrived data, that men and dinosaurs walk together and the world really is only 6,004 years old, and it began on October 11th at 4 p.m, or, you know, some nonsense like that. Think about that for a second. We're going to take another ad break, but I want you to tell me how we deal with this. How do you deal with this? And why is it important to deal with it? I mean, who cares after all? And why? But first, we're going to take an ad break again. This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest today, delighted to have Dr. Tammy Hotchkiss-Reynard of the Origins Center, otherwise known as the Ochre Lady. And she's the one who does all the work with that wonderful material that was painted on cave walls and stones and other things unimaginable years ago all over the world, and why it's important. We'll be right back.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest today, my delight, Dr. Tammy Hotchkiss-Reynard, of the newly appointed head of the Origin Center on the Vitz University campus. And just before the ad break, I asked her, why even bother to try to explain to people who refuse to believe it that the Earth is old, human origins go way back, but they don't go back as far as dinosaurs and trilobites? What is your answer to this, and how do you deal with such views and values?
I suppose I just show the evidence. You know, as you're going through the museum, you see these tools and kind of explain, you know, being at these sites and knowing how far you're digging down, there is just so much evidence that shows this is what happened, and that there's different ways of dating, because people often say, oh, well, the, you know, the one dating method is wrong, so all the dates are wrong, but showing that there are different ways is that we can figure out how old things are when you actually sit at these sites and see how far you're digging down these layers and layers. You see this change in stone tool technology, or you see that bones have transformed into stone. You know, that just, it really needs to take, it takes a very long time for that to happen. So it's very hard to think of things. Yeah, what does, you know, 2,000 years ago, you know, in the archaeological world isn't very much. And we're speaking about, you know, a few hundred thousand years ago or million years ago. And so it's really hard to comprehend it, especially for kids. But I suppose it's showing this evidence and showing how archaeologists and paleoanthropologists and paleontologists try reconstruct that kind of timeline from the evidence that there is.
Part of the problem, I think, you know, where people are habituated now to the idea that an archaeologist or a paleoarchaeologist lowers themselves into a cave and in about 8 seconds discovers the key to the universe or the glowing orb or, you know, something, rather than the ridiculously slow, patient work with a small number 8 camel's hair brush, moving little bits away from some interesting thing that might possibly be the tip of a thigh bone of an ancient pre-hominid creature of some type. And how it's, you know, you grid off that area with string and you document every grain of sand that's moved away so that you preserve the knowledge that's embedded in the surrounding stuff as well as the thing that you prized out of the ground. The painstakingness of it, the slow, patient work is what I think most people don't actually have a grip of.
I agree. Yeah, and that's a lot of archaeology, you know, that you do spend hours and hours and years excavating, you know, meticulously excavating, and a lot of what you find isn't a cool thing. You know, people often ask me, well, what is the best thing you've discovered? And, you know, the best thing might be something that looks very silly to everybody else. But in terms of the question that I'm trying to answer from a certain site or trying to understand from the markings that you find on ochre or the types of stone tools or the way away bones or cut. Those are the little things that archaeologists are wanting to get to. That kind of information is more important than the big things that you're finding. So yeah, it's that slow process. And most of the boxes that are in these storerooms, in these archaeological collections, they full of little things that wouldn't mean much to most people, but can be very, very important for our understanding of the human journey or the site that you're studying.
I watched a film not so very long ago in which one of the startling moments was when someone discovered a bone in which there were essentially parallel markings on it, short, straight lines, not to be having been eaten by a hyena, but having been worked on by someone like us, perhaps, either to get at the meat or to get at
marrow.
The stuff inside the marrow. Thank you. My knowledge is deep on these things. The marrow, or simply for ritual purposes, even. And no one was quite sure, but the fact that they were parallel lines, that doesn't occur in nature all that often, parallel lines. Pythagoras didn't direct hyena teeth. Those little moments of, oh my goodness, look at that, or the scratch on a cave wall that is a grid of some type or other, or a series of dots, all those things.
Yeah.
People like you, that's world shaking. To the rest of us, it's like, oh yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's this teeny little scratch that you think nothing of, but that could tell something about exactly what type of tool make that mark on the bone or on ochre, and it can tell so much more about the kind of abilities the people at that site might have had. So yeah, those little things that might not seem like much, but can tell a lot in terms of our understanding.
Yourself, you obviously, you started somewhere along the way, you started saying, this is what I want to do for my life, my living, my purpose and meaning on this planet. How did that happen? Give me the short version of why did you wake up one morning and say, this is what I want to devote my life to?
Sure. And I think my first realization that it's what I wanted to do is that I came to an open day at Wits with my parents. It would have been in 1998, and came to an open day, and I saw one of the professors, Tom Huffman, with a replica iron smelting furnace, and he had the bellows, and he had this whole furnace of how the early Iron Age farmers would smelt iron. And I just thought, oh, that's cool. And I'd always liked history and discovering things and digging in the sand and being messy and stuff like that. But this was when I decided, okay, I want to study archaeology. And then after my first year of doing archaeology and a whole mix of things, I knew this is what I wanted to do. So it wasn't like a calling necessarily for, you know, my whole life. But it's worked out that it's been a really amazing journey for me.
And do you get to the field much anymore? Is this going to make you desk bound, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a lot of archaeology isn't in the field. You know, you might go out for a few weeks, you know, twice a year to go and dig, and then you spend a lot of the time in the lab analyzing the material or, writing papers and things like that. So but I think the museum is just really, I love it. It's a very, I do different things every day. Sometimes I'm in the museum, fun activities for kids, or in the lab a little bit. I don't do as much research as I would like to and as I need to. But I got into the field maybe once a year, if that.
We're going to take a break again. We were speaking with Dr. Tammy Hodgkins-Reynard, the new head of the Origin Center. I think I've teased her enough by calling her the Oak Lady, even though that's right in the press release, right at the first line. I've seen her work, so I know. But the Origin Center is an important venue. But let's take a quick break, and then let's come back and finish up our conversation with Dr. Tammy Hodgkins-Reynard of the Wits University Origin Center. Dig a little deeper into how people find out about what the Origin Center is doing. And of course, there must be websites and newsletters and who knows what else. So don't stay tuned. Don't leave. Stay with us. We'll be right back after these messages.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest today, I'm really, really delighted, Dr. Tammy Hotchkiss-Reinhardt, who is now the head of the Origin Center on the Fitz University campus. Previously, you were the curator. Was it just you, or did you have assistant curators or volunteers or various other people, students who came in and helped on these things? Obviously, you didn't build all the displays yourself. I mean, you may be really talented, but that's a lot of work.
Can I take the credit? So the museum itself started in 2006, and the core of the museum, the permanent museum, was beautifully put together by a whole team, and specifically, you know, associated with the Rock Art Research Institute here at Fitz. And then I came on only in 2018 as the curator, and it was only me as the curator. We had, you know, have an events coordinator and our front of house and operations staff. And then we have guides, student guides that are part of the team, and interns that come on here and there, you know, sometimes for very short times. So the curatorial job was very much looking in the exhibitions. And then doing the educational programming. So if we do public lectures or kids things or anything like that. We did also have a head guide that came on, and then Mandy Esterhazen, who was the previous head, also an archaeologist. And then I took over from her.
Now, how does somebody find out the upcoming events? There must be a website or some way we can tell listeners, go here and learn and find out and schedule your life and go to the Origin Center. What should they look for?
Yes, we have lots of things going on. So I'd really encourage people to first look at our Instagram and Facebook. So the Instagram is @OriginCenter_Vitz, and Facebook and X are @OriginCenter with an R-E, Centere. And our website, we're in the process of revamping, but we do try, have most of the information is up there, but it doesn't show all the little events that we're having all the time. At the moment, we have two temporary exhibitions, one really large exhibition called Atlas of Uncertainty with 30 artists from around Africa, so from Accra, Nairobi, and Johannesburg, looking at the movement of people and migration and displacement of people. It's a beautiful, beautiful exhibition. It just opened this last weekend. And then Facing the Heat, so looking at climate change by Vishwas Satgar, one of the professors here at Wits, and looking at issues of climate change and how it affects us in South Africa. So those are two that are on at the moment, and you can find the information online, or if there's any events happening, just have a look at our Instagram and Facebook, and our contact details are on there as well.
The offering is obviously more than simply a bunch of old bones and stuff like that. It's obviously you're taking paleoarchaeology and bringing it into the present and the future as a way of understanding, I think. I have one question. It's been burning in my mind now since we started our conversation. There is a cafe or a restaurant in there. I have to know, do you offer a paleo diet?
That's a good suggestion. I must see. So we have a new, not new now, it's been actually a year that the restaurant is now run by Curious Cafe. So it's called Curious Cafe at Origins. They open the same time as us. They offer a great selection of food, but they don't offer a good paleo diet. So maybe we should have some cool offerings that align directly with some of the archaeological or paleo things. It's a good suggestion.
I could see people coming in and arguing about whether the paleo diet is really paleo or is this a modern made-up bit of nonsense. But the restaurant, for those who believe, you know, there's this and this and this, you know, 18,000 calories of protein, however you measure protein in a diet. But it would be great fun, and it could become a sort of people would show up just to partake of the paleo diet and incidentally look at all your displays and offerings.
Yeah, it's a great idea. And so even though, like, when we're thinking of the hunter-gatherers, a lot of, I often say, well, most of their diet would have likely been from, you know, from plants and bulbs and, you know, getting some proteins from that too, but from smaller animals, whereas everyone kind of has this picture that the men were going hunting, you know, every week to get a huge eland. And it wasn't the case at all, you know, at least in the more recent past with these small arrows and an amazing innovative technology. But yeah, it would be quite cool to merge the restaurant offerings and the museum. I like it.
Yeah, I mean, catching a tuber in the ground is quite clearly easier than running, than chasing down an eland, yeah. Getting it with an arrow or a throwing spear, and then dragging it back, all several hundred kilograms of it, dragging it back to a campsite, butchering it. That's an awful lot of work. And then finally beginning to use it, realizing that half of it's going to go to waste before you have a chance. And then you got to fight off the hyenas and the lions and the vultures and who knows what else, as opposed to a basket fill or a skin filled with tubers and plants, which have not run away from you.
Exactly.
Now, communicating that is hard, too, because, you know, we have all been habituated by cartoons and films that the idea was that early man, you know, all 200 or 300 of them gathered together and chased down a mammoth and you know, and that's how it went. The women were busy doing, I guess, catching wild tubers. So how do you communicate this?
Definitely. And then what's preserved in the archaeology is skewed towards the animal bones that preserve easier than the plant material. You know, so you might find animal bones and stone tools. Plants were eaten, or, you know, there's nothing left to show in the archaeological record. So it is quite tricky to reconstruct that and understand the environment and how people lived in the environment and from the environment in the past. It's a tricky one.
As you can probably tell, I'm auditioning for the role of assistant curator at this point.
Great, join us.
I mean, this was always my first love, this kind of thing, as opposed to what I ended up doing in my life. But I have to I haven't been to the Arja Center for a while, but I need to come back and refresh myself and see what's available, what's interesting, and what's going on, especially as you take charge of the reins and lead it into the next decade. We're going to take our last ad break, and we'll be right back after these messages. This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest is Dr. Tammy Hotchkiss-Reinhardt, newly appointed head of the Origin Center on the Vitz campus.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I know I keep saying that, but we'd like to let people know that what they're listening to. Today's guest, I'm really, really pleased, the new director of the Vitz Origin Center, Tammy Hotchkiss-Reinhardt, and we're discussing, well, I've already given a couple of suggestions about the kind of thing that should be offered in the museum. Oh, and I don't want to call it museum because that sort of sounds like there's a bunch of old mummies stuffed away somewhere there. But the place to learn about our human origins and perhaps our human future. If you had, and we just have a minute or two now, what would be your ideal exhibit that you would put in place, money not being the issue, time, staffing not being the issue? What would you like to do if there were no constraints on what it is you could do in that place?
That's a nice question. So we do already have plans to see how we can bring in some more of the early origins, like the origins of life story. So some of these amazing fossils that are just across the road, you know, in storage, dinosaurs and human, ancient life, just generally. It would be amazing to have a display on that. And there are things happening to see how we can do that. Oh, sure. Yeah, that's a cool question. You know, I often don't allow myself to just think if there were no constraints. But I think there's something about dinosaurs, and to keep that story true between that the timeline of, you know, that dinosaurs lived so much further back than humans, but to bring in that whole story of origins.
South Africa is obviously famous for its hominid fossils and related material, but there are vast numbers of wonderful fossils found the age of and before the age of dinosaurs, all those earlier reptiles, amphibians, and all the way back, bony fishes and all the rest of these things. And I don't know if there are any stromatolites. You have a wealth of material that you can show off to people. Yeah. It's virtually unlimited.
Exactly. And people know the American dinosaurs and they don't realize that they were actually amazing animals and dinosaurs and things found in South Africa as well.
I have a 9-month-old grandchild who is absolutely fascinated by a book with dinosaurs in it. And
yeah, kids love dinosaurs.
You got a little press button and you get what appears to have been the roar or the squeak or the squeal of various and sundry creatures. And, I'm hoping I can turn them into a paleoanthropologist by the time we're all over.
Yeah, good.
We have been speaking with Dr. Tammy Hodgkiss-Reynard, the newly appointed head of the VITS Origin Center. And as she says, you can find their presence on the web, the internet, and they have a Facebook page, and you can find them on, what was it, X as well, I think.
But Instagram and Facebook are the two best.
Okay. Sorry, Instagram and Facebook. I'm getting ahead of myself there. But I do want to encourage listeners, if they haven't been or they haven't been for a long time, to make a point, go there, but bring children with, because they will entertain you and fascinate you and astonish you with the questions about what they see in a museum or an institution like this. Always the best thing in the world to go to one of those places with a child, because they don't know what they're not allowed to ask.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, and Origins is definitely not, just a museum. It is really a cool experience. And so I hope people do come and enjoy it and get in touch with me as well.
And we have been, as I say, speaking with Dr. Tammy Hodgkiss-Reynard. She's the new head of the Origin Center. She is a champion of this. And I just gave her all kinds of ideas for exhibitions and way to change the menu in the restaurant. Because I'm auditioning for assistant curator, but never mind. We'll be back again next week with another edition of The Deep Dive. And I'm not going to tell you who it'll be next time, but trust me, we'll somewhere in the range of human experience between nuclear physics, economic perils, our next guest will be on our program. Again, Tammy, thanks for joining us. Thanks for taking time out of your schedule.
Thank you so much.
My listeners, of course, you have a good weekend. Be safe, be careful, and we'll be back again next week.